Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Really 007.
Welcome everyone to the Really 007 podcast, to focus on perhaps the only book of its kind, the James Bond lexicon. Now it's fast approaching Christmas, so it seems like the perfect time to grab a copy of it to send to all our fellow Bond fans, friends and family. And amazingly tonight we are joined by the authors themselves, Alan and Gillian Porter. So good evening, Alan and Gillian.
Good evening.
Evening.
It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Great to see you as well, all the way from America.
Yes, yeah. Texas. I don't know where the count. Depends what day of the week it is, whether we think we're in America or not. But, yeah.
We'll get on to that in a bit. Because we've also got here, we've got John, who's, of course, a regular contributor to our podcast.
Hello. Good
evening, John. And we've also got David, a.k.a. Licensed to Queer, back. So it's great to have him on board.
No, it's great to be back. I love this book so much, so I'm kind of feeling very privileged to talk to its creators.
I will actually say David has a special spot in our hearts because he was the first, the day of release, he was the first person to actually take a selfie with the book and post it online.
Oh, really?
Let us know.
So,
yeah.
If you remember, I accidentally bought two copies. And
I almost thought,
I'll just keep both copies because it's such a good book, but I thought this is ridiculous. So I did a little competition to give it away. So yeah, and that person is very grateful as well.
Cool.
So yes, you were the first person in the Bond community that we knew of that had actually got a copy. So
wow,
we appreciate that.
And that's really why I've insisted that David come on board, because I know he's a massive fan of this book. So
I'm also, just in terms of my kind of academic background, I've also got a degree in linguistics. So I love anything with the word lexicon in there.
Oh, okay.
I suppose you could call me the cunning linguist of the
crew. Yeah.
It is a Bond quote, though, so we'll...
We'll
listeners, there are various places you can find our podcast. We have got websites, we've got iTunes, we're on Spotify. We're also on YouTube now as well, so check out our videos and interviews on there. But thanks for sharing, rating, and recommending our episodes. We can also be found on social media, as we've just mentioned, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Then the shout-out, I always give a shout-out. Tonight I thought, who has got the most encyclopedic knowledge of Bond and who really makes it the be-all and end-all of himself on Twitter? It's got to be the Wizard of Oz. The Wizard of Ice, sorry.
Yeah. You've got Wizard of Ice wrong.
I know, yeah. Just thinking of the film. But
Stop getting Wizard of Ice wrong.
Very good. Yeah. I'll get to stop getting Bond wrong myself there.
Yeah.
Have you come across him on Twitter yet, guys?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just worried that he's corrected you on something in the book.
No, but people are not slow in correcting us if they think they've spotted something wrong in the book. And there are the odd hiccups in there, yeah. So
yeah, I'm looking forward to asking you about that. Not that I've spotted anything myself, so don't worry. Without further ado, it's great to introduce you to the world of Really 007. But first of all, in terms of you growing up, did you meet back in England?
Yeah, we met at college, actually, at Bradford University on our first day at college.
That's amazing. Yeah. And where did James Bond come into your lives? Was it at the same time or did you grow up?
Poor Jill just got dragged along into it and she talked about her Bond experience. But No, for me, Bond started with, again, I'm going to age myself here, the Thunderball board game, which a friend of mine got for his birthday. I think it must have been over the school holidays, and basically we just played it incessantly, and I had no idea who James Bond was, but I figured out that James Bond was the guy with the biggest plastic figure, and he had that cool jetpack on his back, so he must be cool. So I apparently went home and talked about James Bond incessantly, so that Christmas my parents got me the Corgi DB5 and the James Bond annual for that year. A couple of years later, I won a competition in my local newspaper for 2 free tickets to my local Odeon, and I decided to take my dad to see the new James Bond movie, which was On a Majesty's Secret Service. And of course, I've been reading this James Bond annual full of pictures of all the Sean Connery movies, and I'm 10 years old and I'm sitting there and this guy comes on. I'm like, who's that? That's not James Bond. But he won me over very quickly. And then when the guy went under the snowplow and Bond turned around and said he had lots of guts, that was it. I was hooked. I was a Bond fan from that point onwards. So.
Lots of guts.
I mean, just on the thought, Alan, you need to share that story more, because that's usually used as a whipping stick against a George Lazenby, that line. So you're saying that you're hooked because George Lazenby said that
line. I actually told George that when I was lucky enough to meet him, that he was the one who hooked me in and it was that line. So, yeah.
Oh, wow.
What's it been like then, sort of seeing the evolution of James Bond then? So you've seen right from the start, really, haven't you? Sean Connery all the way to Daniel Craig now.
Yeah, pretty much. Yes, I am that old, guys. I'm sorry. it's been really interesting. You know, I'm fans of other franchises as well, but Bond is like been the consistent one. I think it's made me a little bit of a traditionalist when it comes to the Bond series. I like Bond to be given a mission. He goes out, does it, saves the world, and ends up with a girl in a raft, you know, or on a boat. That's how I like my Bond movies. So I'm not being a huge fan of the let's tell a five movie story arc recently, but I have liked odd films in that story arc. But yeah, I'm a bit of a Bond traditionalist, but hopefully I'm not a sort of stick in the mud Bond traditionalist. I can also enjoy other things as they come along. One of the things I always liked about the Bond franchise is the fact, certainly in the early days, that they tended to lead, they tended to try things and do things, which is what they've been doing over the last few movies as well. So, you know, I just love all the things that the Bond franchise has sort of drawn me into, that things like getting to dive into the music, the locations, travel. I think it was Bond that really sparked my love of travel and going to different places and that, and discovering the books and everything else. It's been a very interesting journey, and long may it continue.
It is. It's a massive world now. Obviously, we've got our podcast. David's got his podcast and his website, and you've got your book. So it's just...
And podcast too. So.
And podcast, yes, of course, yeah.
Yeah. I have to say that, otherwise my co-host would tell me off.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting that a board game got you into Bond, because the people of, sorry, I don't want to make anyone feel their age, but the people, a lot of people who are a bit younger than me, well, maybe 10 years younger than me, I've got an important birthday coming up in the next 12 months. But people who are about 10 years younger than me, a lot of those say that they were introduced to Bond through GoldenEye, the video game, and that they didn't know who James Bond was either. So it seems that that's an interesting kind of generational thing. So because of the wider culture around Bond, that can hook people in.
Yeah, and I'm not going to get on my soapbox about Eon missing the younger audience over the last 20 years by doing video games and stuff. But yes, a lot of people discovered Bond in different ways other than the movies, or as Jill will probably say, just because it was like on TV and it was part of our cultural zeitgeist. And I'll shut up and let Jill talk.
My introduction was the Christmas movie.
Yeah.
You know, you had your lunch, you watched The Queen, you watched Top of the Pops, and then you watched the Bond movie.
Yeah.
Mm. That was my introduction, and I didn't really think too much about it. I kind of ended up seeing Moonraker twice at the cinema, because I went with one guy, and then we broke up, and then I started going out with another guy, and he was like, let's go see Moonraker, it's just come out. And it was like, for me, the worst Bond movie I've ever seen at that point. And I was like, to go through it and watch it twice within 2 weeks was just painful. So that kind of put me off for a while.
Because the guy must have been quite attractive, Jill, you know, to put yourself through a Bond movie that you don't like twice.
By the way, this is the first time I have ever heard that story. I mean, to get a 40 that. Years, that's the first time I've heard that.
Yeah, I was getting that vibe, Alan, from your body language.
We offer marriage counselling on our podcast.
Nice to know.
Well, yeah, we I was actually, well, continue with the secrets. No, he knows about this one. I was actually engaged to the guy I saw the Moonraker with twice when Alan and I met. So we rarely talk about him. So there.
Okay.
But yeah, that was, you know, and then we kind of came on gradually until I didn't realize it had become an obsession in our household, along with other obsessions, I will say. And it just kind of came on gradually. The movies came out, you go see them. We talk about the bits we liked. We talk about the bits we hated. And then, you know, the book came about purely because Alan writes all sorts of pop culture stuff and I've edited it for years. And then it got to this bit I was doing a lot more and he was like, well, why don't we do this one together? And I thought, well, that'll be fun. And then there have been a few times over the years when you're like, why on earth did I agree to do this? But, you know, to have it out there and finally done is quite satisfying.
The second time that you've ever seen a Moonraker movie in consecutive days, a Bond movie in consecutive days would be No Time to Die then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And dare I ask what you thought, Gillian?
Loved it.
Oh, phew, right, good.
Yeah,
yeah, we both enjoyed it. You're okay.
Yeah.
Not just us, but people we've been speaking to and debating the film. We're trying to find people with a bit more, something positive to say about it. I know David is a fan as well, so we're in better company perhaps tonight to be positive about it.
I said, I don't know that with the podcasts and the discussions we've done with people that I've really found anyone of you that hasn't.
No, unless we're just being cherry picked for the podcast.
Well, yeah.
But I haven't actually come across anybody in person or on a podcast. I haven't come across anybody yet who doesn't like it. So,
well, I won't say any more. I'll just say it's a very diverse.
John's looking a bit orcs.
I really like the first 2 hours.
Okay, we'll leave it at that then.
Okay. I thought it was a great movie. I thought the ending was fitting for the storyline they told. I just don't know if it was a true Bond movie, if that makes sense. But I did like it, and I thought it just fitted what had gone before. And, you know, as soon as they started playing that, you know, music, you knew one of them was out of there.
Yeah.
And it couldn't have been her. So it made sense in the time. What they'll do next is going to be very interesting.
And the effect that it might have on the book, I suppose, if you do an updated edition of it, that would be interesting.
Well, we sort of do a continual updates on our... We have a companion website for the book, jamesbondlexicon.online, folks, where we actually do new entries as stuff comes out. So since the book came out, there's been a few of the Dynamite Comics series. So we've added, each of those series ends, we've added them to the website. With No Time to Die, once it's out on, you know, on DVD or video, I know it's out on video demand, but, you know, when it's out on DVD or Blu-ray, we'll definitely buy a copy and we'll be freeze framing it and doing all the annotations and updates of that. So that'll be a few months away. But
I'll say to this, his Wii is very sweet because he does the website, he does the updates. I haven't done any of that part. So I do love the fact he says Wii when I am not involved in any way, shape or form right now.
Oh, I'm sure you are in spirit and the editing of it as well. I mean, it must take a heck of a long time to compile the thing, but yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Today, if you didn't guess it already, we're discussing this extraordinary book, the James Bond Lexicon, which is available to buy now. And of course, it was published for the first time in 2021. And it's got a record of pretty much everything contained within the Bond novels, films, comic books, the animated series, James Bond Jr. We haven't even really mentioned that on our podcast. So, and it goes right up, basically up to No Time to Die. And like Alan said, there will be updates on the website for that film as well, because that's going to create hours and hours of more new material. I think it's perfect to have handy when you know, there's a niggling character you want more info on, a niche question you need answering. And, you know, sometimes a Google search isn't good enough for these kind of things. If you want something proper about James Bond, if you've got this book handy, I think it's perfect for that. And much more detailed than even us super nerd Bond fans have ever gone into. So it's a must have, I think. It's also good to have as a reference, say, when you're reading one of the novels or comic books or noticing something you haven't noticed before from one of the films, perhaps the first time, and cross-referencing characters from a novel and a film, because they are quite different in many of the films. I know you've sort of said how the book came about, but what does the process of writing this book involve? I mean, What's the sort of technique you do to go through it meticulously?
It really just becomes, as you said, just working through things, systematically working through everything meticulously. What we did was divide. We thought it was like a divide and conquer approach, that we each took certain things. So, you know, I did the movies and some of the comics. I did the Raymond Benson novels. Jill did Moneypenny, John Gardner. You did the comics, because I'd already written a book about the comic strips, the Daily Express comic strips, back in 2009. So I wanted somebody to come at those fresh. So Jill took the comic strips. And
the young James Bond.
And the young James. Yeah, you took the young Bond. I took James Bond Jr., the aforementioned James Bond Jr.
So, sacrificed himself.
I sacrificed myself. I fell on my sword and watched all 65 episodes of James Bond Jr.
My word.
And read the novelizations and the comic book series. There was so much James. I didn't realize there was actually so much James Bond Jr. stuff. And the funny thing is, actually, since we finished the book, I've actually found out in the UK there was a 4-issue Young Readers at series of James Bond Jr., which we'll have to go in the updates. So I'm busy trying to find copies of those. So yeah, there's a lot of James Bond Jr. stuff out there that I didn't realize.
Bond. James Bond Jr. No one can stop him, but scum always tries. Young Bond cuts through each web of spies. He learned the game from his Uncle James. Now he's James Bond Jr. Look out, he's coming through. He's got a job to do while he rescues the girl. James Bond Jr. chases scum around the world.
Basically, that's how we did it. We just went through individually, made our own notes, entries, and we basically have we used a wiki to write it, so we'd both put them into the wiki and stuff. We did a quick edit through that, and then at one point we basically put everything into a big document and got it printed out, and it was like 700 pages or something of entries. And then we'd spend like an hour in an evening going through, challenging each other as to why we'd written that entry or the way we'd written it, and editing it and cross-editing it.
Sulking.
Yeah, sulking sometimes. Discussing.
Vigorous discussions.
Vigorous discussions sometimes around certain entries. You know, deciding who was going to be. There was quite a bit we did that didn't end up in the book. You know, if it was a character that didn't really advance the plot in any way, we sort of took them out. And, you know, we also trimmed down. We found we both had a tendency to repeat the plot lines in multiple entries, so we had to sort of trim that down. And also, as we were going through compiling the lists at the back of the book, you know, all of Bond's aliases, you know, all of Bond's women, all the cars, all that sort of stuff, all the hotels he stayed in, started compiling those. And that was basically the editing exercise. Now, if I sort of flick through it, I can't really tell who wrote which, because it sort of became an amalgam of the two of us and our two styles for each entry. So yeah, that was pretty much the process behind it.
And it really helped too, because there are some things that the person didn't actually do very much, but there was a lot going on around them. And you'd write it all in, and then between the two of us, you'd be able to say, well, yeah, but all they did was this. So it was really helpful to have that. And especially like with some of the comic strips, it was actually really hard to work out what had gone on, because they were so nutty. It was helpful, because Alan had read them as well, that we could go through them. And sometimes it was going back and reading them again. But yeah, it was very odd. It was very odd, some of those, trying to actually work out what you put, because a lot of the characters weren't given names. It was very weird.
Yeah, the hardest thing really was that we decided fairly early on that, you know, because we've got a lot of these sort of encyclopedias of fictional worlds around the house, and we're like just dipping into them. Like you said, you know, oh, who's that character and so forth. Mm. So we realized early on that basically each of the entries had to be able to stand on its own. Somebody had to be able to just dive in, pick an entry and read it and understand it on its own. So each of them also had to have context that you could actually read it on its own without having to have read anything around it or any of the other relevant entries for that story. And that became quite difficult to actually figure out for each entry. But hopefully we got there.
It's got to have a consistent tone, hasn't it? It's no use if you go on at length on one character and then not on another one. And you've got to, like you say, there's certain characters we might find funny screenshots. I can't believe I mentioned this guy again.
Go on, go for
like
it.
The man with the golden gun, you know, the guy in Thailand. The bad Bonneuve, you know that guy. He's obviously not got a name. He has no bearing really on anything other than my memory. Yeah, people like that, you can't exactly put man who J.W. Pepper caused a crash into a wall or something like that. Line somewhere, don't you?
Tom, but I've got to confess that when I got the PDF, I did go control find and start typing in Debap on Love and see if I can find it.
It's not a phonetic lexicon. So,
yeah.
As a nerd,
he's probably in our notebooks, because you would do that. You'd write down, yep, you know, oh, guy who did this, in the hope that at some point later on in the movie, somebody would actually
mention his name.
Yeah.
As a nerd on how like things like dictionaries are created by people called lexicographers, you know, like people like Samuel Johnson and that sort of thing, I'm finding it fascinating the process that you just went through. I know at the start of the book you say that you intended it, you know, this will only take us a year, but it actually took you nearly 9, didn't it?
Wow.
Yeah. It did. Yeah, 6 years of actual work. There was stops and starts in it. But yes,
Was there ever a point where you thought, oh, we're just never going to get there, let's just give up?
Oh, yeah.
Lots of those.
Yeah,
lots.
Quite a lot of those, yeah. Yeah, particularly when we had a break, and then we decided we were going to come back and finish it. And we had a lot of discussions around, should we finish it? Is there any point in finishing it? You know, and then it was like, no, we're going to go do this. We're going to finish it off.
Well, we also lost our original publisher. So that was a bit where we were like, well, what do we do now? You know, because you kind of get a bit stuck then. If you don't have a publisher, is there any point in keeping going? But at that point, we were relatively close to the end. So we decided, well, even just for ourselves to know we finished it was going to be something. So we decided to keep going at that point. And found another publisher along the way. So it worked out. But it was a moment where we looked at each other and goes, oh, you know, what are we going to do now? Was quite hard, wasn't it?
Yep.
You've got to tailor it to what the publisher wants as well, because they might not have the same, you know, word count or any things like that. And
yeah, well, the original publisher, when we actually did that first one and it came out at 700 pages, he was like, this might be 2 volumes. And I'm like, I actually really don't want 2 volumes. I want to try and keep it as one and stuff. Because they'd actually already done a couple of other lexicons. They'd done a Planet of the Apes lexicon and a Back to the Future one. They'd obviously developed a house style of how they wanted stuff laid out in those other two. So at one point we literally had to go through and change certain dashes to colons in every single entry to meet their style and stuff like that. So
I'm surprised you say that you took stuff out, because you can open any page of this book.
Yeah,
like I literally just opened it up to find out, and I've just found out the name of the naval commander at the submarine pen in the Spy Who Loved Me movie, and I'm like, where is that in the dialogue?
Yeah.
I'm going back through the film in my head, and I'm sure they mentioned Benson at some point, but maybe they don't. I don't know, but I've never noticed that detail. And Spy Who Loved Me is one of those Bond films I thought I could quote verbatim. And I'm like, what? I'm just like, honestly, you can't open a page of this book without noting, without learning something that you didn't know before.
Yeah.
How did you decide that threshold of what doesn't get included? Because that seems like some pretty esoteric kind of knowledge, the name of the naval base commander.
Well, a lot of it was, if they didn't have a name, if they were like thug number two, who just stood in the background looking threatening, they were out.
Right.
That was really that kind of thing. People who didn't push the narrative, you didn't really have much to say. And especially if they didn't have a name, that would have made it, you know, how do you put somebody in who doesn't have a name? Made it easier to get rid of those. And then Alan can tell you about the one.
I was going to say, but we did miss some people, and I'm going to look it up on the website just to make sure I get this right. we've had some interesting conversations since then from people who have like, you know, I think I did do say in the beginning of the book, you know, if we missed your favorite characters, sorry, you know, if you had a favorite thug, you know, and we didn't put him in.
How did you decide how long to make some of the entries? Was it literally just like, we've exhausted material on this person? Or did you kind of have personal favorites and you thought, I want to write more about them?
Yeah, we did find there were some of them that we ended up with really long entries. And then it's like, well, they actually really didn't do that much. Do they deserve, you know, if you look at some of the Bond girls have got really long entries, and some of them have got really short entries because
they didn't really do much.
They didn't really fill out the characters much in terms of backstory on others. And of course, the others, you know, if they were in like novelizations, I think the Benson thing actually comes from the movie novelization, not necessarily the movie.
Oh, right.
I think, without looking it up. If only there was a book where I could look that up. We ended up with a bit of a different weighting, I guess, depending on how much information there was out there. I mean, if you think about Jaws, there's hardly anything about him in the movies. But if you go in the novelization, it gives like his real name, his whole backstory, how he ended up with the jaw injury, how he ended up working for Stromberg and stuff like that. So, you know, he's got a really long entry compared to what he did on screen. So the one we missed, one of my co-hosts pointed on a Magic Seeker podcast, pointed it out because it's one of his favorite background characters, was Green 4 in The Living Daylights, the agent in the kitchen who has that awesome fight. We missed him. He's not in the book. But he's now on the website. He is on the website. I just looked it up. He is on the website.
So yeah. I mean, it's a great scene, isn't it? But I was thinking recently, is that Green Fort base? Is that whoever's at that location? Doesn't necessarily mean that's his name. It's like,
I know, but that's the code name or whatever.
I can't help it at this point. I don't know if anyone here is we're all British. I don't know if anyone here is kind of like a fan of Blackadder, but I'm imagining the scene where they have Samuel Johnson play Bobby Coltrane and he's realizing that he's finished his dictionary and he hasn't got like some stuff in there, like the word sausage. And that sausage. Kind of thing, and sausage, you know, it's that kind of like, oh, God.
I have a novel. Once upon a time, there was a lovely little sausage called Sausage. Sausage! Blast your eyes!
Oh, well, I didn't think it was that bad.
I think you'll find he left sausage out of his dictionary. Oh, an aardvark.
How anxious did you feel about being completist?
As Jill said, we have a few obsessions around this house. I am somewhat of a completist when it comes. I used to have a massive Batman collection, which we liquidated over the years. So I'm very much a completist. On if I get into something, I really go deep on it.
He has to have all the covers, all the different versions of the Ian Fleming novels. He has to have all of them.
Yeah, Joe can't understand why I need 14 different copies of Casino Royale in my office, but...
Jill, I think my husband would feel your pain.
Well, see, I'm a huge Agatha Christie fan. I have almost all of her books, and when we were moving some, one fell apart, and Alan was like, oh, you need to get that one. And I said, actually, I don't, because it's in this compilation. So I have the story, but he's like, but you don't have the paperback. And I'm like... I don't care. I still have the story. That's the important bit for me.
No.
But no.
No, I do that whenever I'm book shopping, I take pictures of, you know, if I see a Christie thing, I send it to her. And I, oh, do you have this edition? She's like, I've got the book. And I'm like, yeah, but do you have this edition? She's like, I don't care. It's like, ah!
Well, be fair. Agatha Christie wrote an awful lot more than Ian Fleming did.
So I actually wanted to, another one that wasn't in the book, and this is a slightly different approach. So actually every day on our Bond Lexicon Twitter account, I put an entry from the lexicon each day. I think we're in the middle of the letter H. And I put one up for somebody called Harling, who was in the book. And I got a note from somebody saying, yeah, but isn't that also the name of the guy who was the typesetter in The Spy Who Loved Me? And I'm like, I think so, but I'm not sure. So she actually sent me a picture of the page out of the novel with the name. And it's like, okay, that's going on the website. Well, I'm going to have to, I said, I'll make you a promise. We'll put him on the website. So yeah. So the typesetter of the newspaper that Vivian Michaels worked at is now on the website.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
So you think we're deep Bond geeks? There's always somebody out there who knows
what it is. Disappointed they didn't find this person.
I can't believe it.
But it's cool. It's cool that people find these things and send them, because, you know, it means that we're not the only people that are that nerdy and care, you know?
And clearly that person was someone who really knew that novel. And I think one of the things that instantly endeared me to this book when I first got it was that there is no seeming like preference for some of the stories over others. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't have an affinity with James Bond Jr. I was too old to watch it really when the cartoons were on TV. But you've gone there. But the one that I do love, which doesn't get much love, but does in your book, including several illustrations and detailed entries, is Casino Royale 1967.
Yeah,
I love film.
Oh, thank you. So do I. I will defend it to the ends of the earth. I will defend that movie, and have done on several podcasts already.
Yeah, I wrote a 9,000-word article about it last year, so it was definitely a passion project of mine.
One of the things we try to do right up front is actually not show bias. Yes, we've clearly got our favorite movies. We got movies we don't like. We got our favorite books, but the idea was to be as factual as possible. You know, this was about cataloging or annotating the stories, the 271 officially licensed James Bond stories that we covered, and trying not to show any bias at all, which was actually at times quite hard.
Yeah.
Was it quite difficult to see what's canon and what is non-canon?
What we did was, if it was licensed by Eon or Ian Fleming Publications, then we counted it. If it wasn't licensed, then we didn't cover it. Because people, you know, I've had people saying, you know, well, you know, what about Bond? You know, Bond appears in, just going to the comics, the Alan Moore League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I think it's like the third or fourth volume. And the most recent one, the Tempest one, there's like a whole Bond thing of running through of the multiple Bonds. Bond, you know, Kim Newman's book, Anna Dracula, has a Scottish agent who drives a silver sports car, hint, hint. You know, there's lots of those. You know, there's a copy of Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. where Bond turns up outside S.H.I.E.L.D.'s headquarters, but they're not licensed by, you know, those are not officially licensed appearances, so they didn't make the book. So that was really our guardrails, was this an officially licensed thing, which is why Casino Royale 67 is in there, because it was an officially sanctioned project. It's why Never Say Never's in there, because, you know, they had the rights to do it.
You say you worked with the Ian Fleming Foundation. Can you just tell us a bit about that? That's fascinating in itself.
So the Ian Fleming Foundation, which is not Ian Fleming Publications, Ian Fleming Publications hold the rights for, you know, Ian Fleming's books and stuff. The Ian Fleming Foundation is a non-profit organization here in the US. It is chartered with promoting the works of Ian Fleming and encouraging literature studies at several universities. We actually run scholarships at several universities here in the US. So that's the official blurb. The really cool way is the way that we raise money for those scholarships is we actually rescue and restore James Bond movie vehicles and props. And we currently own about 40 James Bond movie vehicles. Most 19 out of the vehicles that were in the Bond in Motion in London. Ian Fleming Foundation, the one that's just opened in the US, I think they have about 30 of our vehicles in. We have literally, I don't know if you saw it on Twitter, I just posted the pictures on Twitter this week. Our latest acquisition is the front 25 feet of Goldfinger's Lucky Jetstar from the movie, which was found in a scrapyard in Missouri and is in a hell of a state. But it's going to be a long-term restoration project. So, yeah, so twice a year, Jill and I go up there, up to our workshops and get to work. Very diligently on helping to restore James Bond movie vehicles.
It's funny you say that, because I know I'm not very good at cars, to be honest, apart from the star vehicles in each of the books and the films. But there's like a whole page of just Bentleys here.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I was like, you know, someone has clearly paid a particular attention to cars.
Yeah, that sort of got me what into the Ian Fleming Foundation. I'm going to sort of name drop here, but I was doing a book signing for my previous Bond book alongside Raymond Benson. We were doing a joint book signing at a bookstore in Houston. And we were having dinner afterwards and we were just chatting. And Raymond said, well, you clearly know Bond. Obviously, from the conversations, you're clearly into vehicles and cars and planes and stuff. He said, I've got a bunch of guys that you should meet. And he sort of gave us the intro to the guys at the Ian Fleming Foundation. Been going, 10 years now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just over 10 years. Yeah. So we've got to work on some really cool stuff. Sometimes when you just walk in that work, I mean, every time we go up there and you will just walk into the workshop and just see what's there, it's just like, pinch me, this can't be real.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Can I please ask if about...
We can sit in them and...
Selfies. Come on.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We have a lot of those.
We have a lot of selfies, yeah.
Sorry.
So I was talking to the guys on the, I think, sorry to name
drop. No, you go.
I was talking to the guys on the Bond and Beyond podcast, and we actually, between us, we figured out that actually my arse has sat where every James Bond arse has sat. So all six of them, yes. Yeah. So.
Are we including David Niven though?
I was just saying,
Eon.
I love the illustration of David Niven in this book.
Yeah.
Yeah, the illustrations are amazing.
Yeah, I was going to mention them.
Yeah, he did an amazing job. I mean, I didn't really know Pat at the time. He'd done, like I said, our first publisher had done another couple of lexicons, and Pat had done the illustrations for those. So when we started, they were like, oh, yeah, we've got somebody who can do the illustrations. And I was like, oh, okay, this is what, you know, can we have like 20, we want like an illustration for each letter of the alphabet. So we want like 26 and maybe, you know, maybe a couple of others. And Pat turned in 80. And they were, when the first ones kept coming in the email box, I was like, these are amazing. And I reached out to Pat, and it turns out, yeah, I'm a big James Bond fan. I was just, you know, you asked me to draw James Bond, I'd be doing it anyway. So they are absolutely amazing.
Pat actually apparently did, you may or may not be aware of my fandom for Jim Fanning. who, of course, is in the book. He wasn't.
Yes. Great character.
As it says here, the Secret Service's resident fine art expert. He identified the Fabergé egg recovered by 009. Nothing about a bow tie, but I'll forgive that omission.
Sorry.
Pat actually said that I think he did an illustration of Fanning, but it didn't quite hit the book was already being printed by that point. But he sent me the image anyway.
I was
incredibly honoured to actually be able to see that. So that was really
nice. Very cool. Yeah.
I mean, my observation with the pictures, firstly, I absolutely love how under Felix Leiter, that you've got the definitive Felix Leiter, David Hedison. That was the right picture.
Absolutely. That was a bit of bias. I will say that was a bit of bias.
Yeah. I was chuffed to bits when I saw that. But the other one, and my question was actually about how did you choose which pictures to get? But I think you probably answered that with doing one for each letter. Because I was absolutely fascinated that you, for the picture of V, you had Vavra, because this is a character that I've watched From Russia with Love hundreds of times, know who he is, but never knew he even had a name. And all of a sudden, I've got this massive picture of, this is Vavra. This book, look at him.
Oh, yeah.
This book is just incredible. It's, so I've made it. So on, go for it.
I will tell you a secret. So, David, turn to the letter I.
I'm going to I now. Hang on. This is fascinating audio. Amanda. Okay. So
it's a great podcast. Okay. So what does that picture have to do with the letter I?
Isn't that the brandy he's drinking? No?
Well, actually, it has nothing, because when we were putting the book together, I suddenly realized that we did not actually have an image for the letter I for the main image. And then I remembered the quote that when he's drinking that brandy, he says something like an intriguing blend of something and something. And I'm like, we use the word intriguing. Okay, I'm going to we use the word intriguing. I'm going to put that picture on the letter I. Yeah, because that was a momentary.
Oh, wow.
Pity about your liver, sir. It's an unusually fine Solera. 51, I believe.
There is no year for sherry, 007.
I was referring to the original vintage on which the sherry is based, sir. 1851. Unmistakable.
I was trying to work that out, actually, and I thought, I'm sure Alan and Gillian can tell me. But,
no, I didn't know that one. I didn't know that.
I love how some of the illustrations, and this is what I love about Pat's art generally, is that he doesn't just copy existing images. He puts them in new poses. So even though you didn't choose the best Blofeld in my book, which of course is Charles Gray, not Telly Savalas. I can see John looking at me now. We have a friendly rivalry going on between Diamond and Non-Imaginative Secret Service. We'll get to continuity in a minute, John.
We will.
but we've got Telly Savalas Blofeld. But if you've got the book, turn to that image, because it is like the campest as Christmas image of that Blofeld. I get so sick to death of people saying, Telly Savalas is the best Blofeld because he's a physical threat, blah, 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 blah. But here he is cradling the white cat with his cigarette in that wonderful position, but then that image never quite appears in the movie. I just love it.
I will say one of the things Pat's Donald Pleasance Blofeld, his illustration of that, I think he gets Blofeld's menace across much better in that picture than Donald Pleasance actually did in the movie. I think he's much more scary in Pat. I mean, it is clearly Donald Pleasance's Blofeld, but I think he's a lot scarier in that image than he actually ever felt in the movie. That was one of the ones that when I opened it in my email and it sort of popped up on my screen, I was like, oh my God, that's brilliant.
Comic book sensibilities are amazing of them. Yeah. They make them larger than life and
Am I right in saying that the longest entry in the book is actually Bond himself? I love. I mean, this book is obviously an invaluable resource, but it's got a couple of really interesting like essays/articles at the start, particularly around continuity in the world of Bond. And this, again, where John and I may have a friendly disagreement, because John can't handle it that in Diamonds Are Forever, Bond basically moves on so quickly after his wife's death and finds Moneypenny's line about getting a diamond ring. It just cuts to the heart of him, really. Whereas you, am I right in saying the kind of gist of your article is essentially yes, it's a bit irksome, the lack of continuity, but just get over it, everybody.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And considering we just wrote a book of, what, 454 pages, which is actually completely based on the idea of Bond continuity, that I actually lead it with a essay about just get over it, I think is a bit ironic. But
I can see that's fuming.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. I'm all for it. You know, my qualms with Diamonds Are Forever and on the Majesty's Secret Service continuity are nothing compared to putting the Daniel Craig timeline in its own separate universe and then throwing Doctor No references all over No Time to Die. That's far more confusing to me.
This essay starts with the DB5 in Skyfall, John. So, you know.
Yeah,
but he won it in a card game at Casino Royale, so it's okay.
No, it's a different DB5.
Different DB5.
Oh, anyway, can I ask a question about the making of the book, please?
They actually wanted to use Purvis and Wade wrote it in as if it was the DB5 from the card game in Casino Royale in the script, but Sam Mendes wanted the Goldfinger DB5.
Ejector seat and everything.
Ejector seat and everything.
Q could have modified it, though. That's what I always say.
What, in that time frame? There's only like 2 months between those two scenes, if you think about them. Yeah.
I think I'm going to have
it's a rabbit hole.
I'm going to have to read your essay just to get it into my brain. Get over it, John. I think that's the only reason.
The James Bond entry has 28 different James Bonds.
Yes.
So
that's probably a conservative estimate, because the one thing we didn't cover in here is the video games, because we're not gamers and it's not an area. No. Or the role-playing games, which, again, people have offered to help us do for the future. So there's probably way more than 28 versions of Bond out there, but those are the 28 that we covered, found and covered.
Wow.
That actually sort of helps perhaps the argument that the ending of No Time to Die isn't as massive as some might make you think, if there are so many ones. But I wanted to ask you about what your thoughts on that were in terms of the continuity. And what do you think, sort of, not saddos like us, what do you think the casual viewer would make of all that?
Interestingly, I'm going to take this one. Interestingly, last Sunday I was getting my hair done, because you might not believe it, but this colour is not natural.
What?
Are we going magenta? I'm not very good on coloured names.
No, but it's a mixture of four different colours. Wow. So who the hell knows it's called? Thank you. But I was at my hairdresser's for like 5 hours last Sunday, and we're talking about it, and we end up talking about No Time to Die because she'd recently seen it. You know, she's a fan, but not obviously as deep as us. And she was like, well, what are they going to do now? You know, she was in a total panic. Is Bond gone? Are we finished? Is that it? We're not going to get any more Bond movies? I think that might be your casual viewer, because I've had a few comments from that from other people too, that, oh, what happens now? You know, or I'm so sad Daniel Craig's gone. I think he's really hot. And I'm like, well, that's your opinion, but whatever. But yeah, that's the opinion I've been hearing is, does that mean we're done with Bond, or is it going to be Nomi as 007? And I'm like, well, it does say at the end of the credits, James Bond will be back.
Yeah.
Say 007 will be back. So
for the casual viewer, I think the fact that they put that right at the very end of the very end credits was the wrong thing to do. I think it should have been where it traditionally was at the end of the cast list, where people would have still basically been seen, because there's only, you know, it still blows my mind when I go and see a Marvel movie, half the people get up and leave before the end of the credits. I'm like, you're missing part of the movie. But, you know, most people are going to get up and wander out the cinema. There's only going to be us weirdos who, you know, sit there and watch every single credit scroll by and see that James Bond will return at the end. So most people these days understand that, you know, actors get replaced, things get rebooted. You know, people didn't really have a problem that the Daniel Craig movies were a reboot of what went before. It's like I said, it's only us people who, you know, go, what the hell's that DB5 doing there? Most people would have been just like, oh, that's cool. It'll come back, they'll do something, and we'll all settle down in the movie theater and hopefully watch a gun barrel and just enjoy what comes next. So you asked earlier about watching that sort of, you know, the Bond franchise over the years, all the way from Connery through to Daniel Craig. The one thing I've learned is just to sit back and enjoy the movies, each movie that comes out.
Yeah.
Oh, that is a lie. I not enjoy all the movies.
I said as they come out. I might think my opinion may change over time. Skyfall.
Has it gone up or down? Or
down.
Oh, wow.
Rapidly
down. The same.
Yeah.
Yes,
Quantum of Solace went up on a rewatch.
Yes. Correct, yes.
Yes.
Not for John, but...
Shame to be a
bit picked on, John.
But I found with Casino Royale, Alan had to put up with after, because we did a rewatch before going to see No Time to Die, and we were, after Casino Royale, I'd be sat there going, but why? And I would go off on these rants about things. And now I've really thought about the plot holes in that movie. I don't think I like it quite as much as I used to.
Yeah, we disagree on that one. Still. One of my top ones. Yeah,
do you find that was our front doorbell, just in case
someone's
you're wondering.
Yes,
thank you, Google. All right. My husband's going to get the door now. This is the Perils of Live Podcasting on a Sunday. And the man is now knocking the door. Anyway, what I was going to say is, did you find as you were doing your massive project that you kind of, your appreciation changed because you were having to look in so much detail? That's what I certainly found when I looked at Quantum of Solace in detail. I was like, because I was having to slow it down, because that film is so bloody fast, because I was having to slow it down, I actually kind of appreciated it more. Did you find that with any of these films, books, comics, etc.?
Yeah, I think so. Because you start to pick up the nuances. You start to pick up things that maybe do slide by too quickly, particularly in the movies. And in the books too, some of the references. You know, when you've done a deep dive and then you further in the books, you're like, oh, okay, I can see how that works, or why this character was brought back or not. You can actually also see the plot holes a lot more too. So, you know, you're like, well, hang on. Particularly when you're trying to write like an entry around somebody and you're going back to like a previous appearance, or, you know, where they fit within the overall story, and you start to realize that things actually don't add up the way that you maybe previously thought they did. So yeah, I think it worked both ways. There were certain things they appreciated more and other things. I think the one, you know, from just the Fleming novels, I think it pushed Moonraker to the top of my Fleming novel list. I really enjoyed that one. That happened. As you said, that, you know, the more we dove into Skyfall, the quicker it dropped down the list. You know,
I didn't like it anyway, so it didn't have very far to fall in my
Yeah, that was one of those movies we came out and I was like, I quite enjoyed that. And then we sat down and had a pizza and a beer, and Jill's going, well, what about this? What about this? What about, and I'm like, geez, within about half an hour, she's like completely changed my mind about the movie.
I think it's just such a product of its time.
Yeah.
And it is.
And it's interesting. Yeah. You actually include the Olympics video with the Queen in your book, and it's kind of that time, isn't it?
Yeah.
So What are the entries actually to do? Because I've gone through it trying to find as many as I can, but what are apart from, you know, the plot detail of one day James Bond went and took the Queen out in a helicopter and she jumped out, how many entries does that bit appear in?
I think that's probably it. I think it's just that one. It's that version of James Bond. Yeah, because I don't think I actually put an entry in for Queen Elizabeth II. Maybe
I did look. And also corgis.
Really.
I thought the level of detail in this book, I thought there might be something about corgi dogs.
Hi, this is Julie T. Wallace. You're about to listen to Really 007 Podcast.
You mentioned the vehicles, and you've obviously had a lot to do with those in real life. Yeah. I find it brilliant that you'd given a list of all the number plates for every single car and vehicle that's been in. I mean, this is the stuff of pub quiz dreams.
Yeah.
This is incredible.
It is, yeah. So actually, back in May, so the book came out in April, and in May we had the first of this year's Ian Fleming Foundation meetups, which was an interesting one because basically all the vehicles had just come back from the Bond in Motion in London. So we got to play with some of the vehicles that we hadn't before because they'd been in London, which was cool. One of the guys was like, well, if you guys come out, can we celebrate the book coming out? Can you do a quiz for the members of the Ian Fleming Foundation who are there that weekend? So we're like, okay, we're going to do this. But this is, you know, guys who are real deep Bond geeks and into it. So they told us
to make it hard.
They said, make it as hard as you can. We demolished them. There was guys there who, you know, had been Bond geeks for like 50 odd years, 60 odd years. And they were like, I don't know. But we have done a couple of trivia nights since then, and we've made it a lot easier. But
have you been invited on the Thunderballs radio quiz yet?
No, not yet.
Okay, so on that, I think that you would demolish that, to be honest. They have some very, very tricky questions, but I think you could become the
Yeah, but is it an open book exam?
The
number plates thing was interesting because I was going through, and I kept thinking, we're missing the number plate from the car from GoldenEye. And then it was like, I saw a picture online and it's like, oh, there is no front number plate. Maybe they just blanked it out. And then I went, but it must be in the movie because they drive it. So it must be registered. So I'm going through the movie. And it isn't, because they only drive it on a dirt road in Cuba. So it's actually never driven on the public road in the movie. So it actually doesn't have a front number plate, doesn't have a registration plate in the movie. But that was driving me nuts because I was like, I'm sure the most, I've got to be able to find the registration plate of that BMW Z3 somewhere, but it doesn't have one.
So can I just put something in there?
Yeah.
I have got a toy car of that Z3.
Yeah.
And it does have a number plate on the back of it.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm not,
oh, well, the Corgi
it's
one?
It's the Corgi one, yeah.
Damn, that's on my, it's on my shelf in the office. Maybe I didn't turn it around.
I am 90% sure there is one on the back on the Corgi one.
Okay.
So you might want to check that out.
I'm going to check that out. Check that out right
and,
after
and
this.
And if I'm talking nonsense, you might want to cut this out of the podcast.
You may be right. You may be right.
You just ruined Alan's Sunday.
Or me, did. I don't know. You know, I might be healthy. Yeah.
I don't know. I might have made it someday.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually one of the fun things. I mentioned it earlier. You know, people just do come up with this stuff. It's like, hey, what about this? What about that? And it's like, oh, okay. You know, if there's evidence for it, we'll add it to the, you know, the updates on the website.
Roughly sourced. No fake news.
Nope.
Can I ask about the process of doing it as a man and wife? Is that all right? The reason why this is that my wife hates James Bond, right? She despises it.
Oh, dear.
And I was saying to Tommy, she's currently recovering from a knee operation, so she's immobile. So all I'm having to do, I'm just sitting at home just watching films with her at the moment. And it was my choice for a film last night. And I thought, right, if there is any time to get her into James Bond, it's while she cannot get up off the couch. And if I put if I put her phone in the other room, she has to watch it. For my sins, I don't know why I did it, but I thought the best film for her to watch was A View to a Kill, which like
Well, that's it. She's never.
I think it was the Christopher Walken approach that I thought got it, but it was a bad shot. It was an own goal from me, and I think that I've come to the conclusion that my marriage is never going to include James Bond. It's just going to be the second part of my life that I hide away from my wife. But the process of managing to write a book together, but obviously it being also all consuming as well. Can you still have Bond as a thing that you enjoy together as a couple, or does it blur into work so much these days as well?
It sounds like therapy, John.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, you did say earlier.
I apologize. Providing listening services to people is what I do on a day-to-day job. I did not mean to become a therapist by any stretch. I apologize.
Yeah, Bond is still a thing we enjoy. We still talk about it. Probably add way too much for normal people.
I will say, doing the comic strips, I thought maybe he hated me because some of them were so absolutely ridiculous. I'm like, why is he making me read these things?
But I was doing James Bond Jr. at the same time, so I'm like, that's equal sacrifice.
No, I don't think it's affected our enjoyment. In some respects, I think it's improved mine because I know so much more than I did before. And through it, I've got to sit in some very cool cars, and I've driven Pierce Brosnan around
in Daniel Craig's
car. Mondeo. So
excuse me,
just a model. There's a we have this life-size dummy of Pierce Brosnan as James Bond in his dinner suit, and he sits around, and occasionally he gets a big martini glass, and other times he gets a little martini glass, and he sits in chairs or he sits in cars, and he just kind of moves around the space at times. But he was in the back of the car when. Basically, I don't have that much muscle. So it was like, well, she can drive it, well, we all push it. So, because it doesn't have an engine. So I was joking about that. I drove Pierce Brosnan around in Daniel Craig's car.
I think we should start a Twitter competition. Finish this sentence. If I had a life-size dummy of Pierce Brosnan, I would.
Well, actually, I don't know if you can see this, but this is actually Jill attacking Pierce Brosnan with a lint roller in a very, very personal.
Yeah.
He was very dusty.
Oh, wow.
He was very dusty. They'd been sanding down something in the hangar. And
Pierce actually has good readings.
Oh, he knows, doesn't he?
Oh, that's wonderful.
But yeah, it's a life-size dummy they use for distance shots in The World Is Not Enough. So, yeah.
So good.
I don't want anyone to make some joke about, oh, Pierce Brosnan is a dummy or anything. I don't want to hear anything.
No. He's our favourite Bond.
So. Yeah.
Oh, is he? Oh, brilliant. Yes. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Please say why, because this is brilliant.
I think Pierce, for me, When I think about Bond and what I want Bond to be, Pierce, I think, is the closest to it. I'll give Timothy, Tim is the closest to Fleming's Bond, but Pierce is the closest to my Bond in my head. It's not that I see Pierce when I'm like necessarily reading the books. It's all an amalgam of the various interpretations. But if you ask me for, you know, somebody who looks sharp, can do the action, can do the humor, can do the serious stuff, enjoys his job, unlike a certain person.
Not paid you to say this. This is not,
So, yeah, he clearly enjoys being James Bond. He clearly enjoyed having been James Bond, because he still talks about it and still, you know, gets engaged with the fans and stuff. I will say he's probably the only man on earth who's made me question my own sexuality too.
Yeah, but, I'm with you, Alan.
I had my tuxedo made like Piers's in Die Another Day. So,
wow.
Yeah. So,
so you guys, massive fans of The World Is Not Enough.
No.
Oh.
I like it.
So well.
I like it. So
yeah.
Goldeneye is my favorite.
Goldeneye is our favorite. Super film. Yeah. Yeah. Goldeneye is probably the movie you said about enjoying Bond. If we want to sit down and say, let's watch a Bond movie tonight, I would say probably 70% of the time it's Goldeneye that gets put on.
See, it's Tomorrow Never Dies in our house.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. What a collection. But Jill, why is Pierce your favourite then?
Most of the reasons Alan said, plus he's sexy as hell. I mean,
so I'll tell you our favorite Pierce Brosnan story. So I mentioned it right up front. We live in Texas. We live in Austin, in the center of Texas, which has a big film and TV presence here. They make a lot of movies here. We were out one day with our daughter and son-in-law out in the Texas Hill Country and driving back, and we were like, where should we stop for lunch? And it's like, oh, let's go to there's a particular Tex-Mex place in downtown Austin that we like to go to. And it's like, oh, well, let's go there. So we stop there and I'm sat at the table and I pull my phone out, flicking through Instagram. And there's Pierce's Instagram is a picture of him sat at that restaurant about an hour before we got there.
And you're like, damn.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Yeah. Because he was in town.
He was in town filming that Western series he did recently for
The Sun.
The Sun, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was coming to Austin a lot, yeah. And he was actually, he put a picture of himself sitting on the patio eating his chips and queso at that particular Tex-Mex. And we're like, really? An hour? We missed him like by an hour.
Of all the places.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was here for quite a long time and you kind of hoped that you were going to meet him, but we never did.
No.
So. Oh, dear.
It's very
There's sad. Time yet. There's time.
Yeah, I mean, I like Timothy Dalton too, but his haircut drove me nuts, which is, I know, a bit silly, but his haircut, and it was sadly just the wrong time for a more serious Bond. Mm. I think it was a bit too jarring after Roger Moore. I don't know if I'm, because during our rewatch, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to rewatch a Roger Moore movie after we watch them, because I just found them too hard to watch.
A few weeks ago, my husband and I had a couple of our friends round, a married couple, two lesbians. So it was kind of like two gays and two lesbians watching Bond films together.
So there's a title for a podcast.
Well, yeah, I already did. I did record it. So if you wanted to listen to it, it was kind of a last minute thing. I just grabbed the laptop and put it there, because we had such strong views. But to cut a long story short, we ended up doing a double bill, and the Martinis were responsible for this, of Casino Royale. So one of them had never seen a Bond film before of any description, and the other one loved Bond films as a kid. But because she was a girl and she was growing up in Ireland in the 90s, it wasn't a girl thing to do. So she'd kind of been forced out of loving Bond. But we watched Casino Royale and they both loved that. And then we did it very similar to what John's just said. As he was saying, I was cringing. My husband then decided we were then going to follow that with A View to a Kill. And I was like...
Cheer you up.
I don't think you can imagine two more different Bond films. I think it's really a struggle. And so, honestly, they didn't know what had hit them. Neither of them had seen A View to a Kill. And it gets to the iceberg at the end of View to a Kill. And it was just like, what are we watching? Oh, God. It was a mistake. But fortunately, I don't think we've put them off Bond forever, because we're going to do round two fairly soon. But it does take some careful programming of Bond.
It does, yeah.
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 Quantum of Solace and Moonraker could be a good double bill, couldn't it? In that order to cheer you up.
Oh, dear.
Hi, I'm Rob.
I'm Simon.
And I'm James.
We want to talk about those movies. Those supposedly bad movies. Those movies that bombed.
To see if they weren't that bad after all,
Join us every other Tuesday on the For Your Reconsideration podcast, part of the Pod Dojo podcast network.
You can catch us on iTunes, Spotify, and all your usual podcast apps.
And it won't cost you a solitary bean, mate.
It's like it's free.
It's just like it's free.
Just going back to the book, guys. What?
Oh, yeah, we were talking about book, weren't we?
Yeah, yeah, we were. Yeah.
What book?
I know that Chris, one of our guys on the podcast, Chris Goldie, loves this book. And one of the bits he would love the most is the list of all the 00 agents in the series. Mm-hmm. That I absolutely love that so much. Because you hear the odd little story here and there throughout the series, don't you? And you're trying to think, there's like been more than one of the 00 numbers, haven't there? It's not like there was 001 was in one film, 009 was in another.
No.
There's been multiple ones of some of the numbers.
Yeah, there has, yeah. I mean, I got into a discussion online the other week on somebody was like, well, there can only be 300s and there's this number and that number. And I'm like, no, everything from 00 to 0013's been used, and some of them multiple times with different agents and stuff. And some, I can't remember which one is the one that's, I think it's 008 or 009 is the one that's been allocated the most.
I'd say it's
been allocated the most.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, you don't fare very well if you're 008 or 009.
No, you don't.
Do
you think there's an element of hubris in that? Because obviously they're not supposed to be better or weaker. You know, I think
Well, Fleming said the thing is also they can't be consecutive numbers, but you could pick your own number. So that because that thing about, you know, if you 007, if you don't do this, we'll replace you by 008. Well, by Fleming's rules, if there's a 007, there can't be a 008 because there was only meant to be three of them and they couldn't have consecutive numbers. But the whole 00 thing is very interesting, you know, the whole background to it, you know, where just getting into the sort of the Fleming scholarship, where it came from and how it's used. And of course, one of the great fun things about the British being a Brit in America is, of course, to an American, it is not actually 007, it's 007 because they, you know, it's a British thing to pronounce the letter, the number zero as O. We Brits do it, but Americans don't, so they get confused by that. And it's like, why is it 00 when his number's 007? And it's like, well, it's written 007, but you say it 007. And I'm like, why? And like, it's a British thing, just go with it, you know.
you've also got the code numbers for like so many other agents, like not 00s. Like, I didn't know Vespaline. I'm sure I must have come across it at some point, but Vespaline's code number. Anyone know what that is? Apart from Alan and Jill? Yeah, it's 30-30 apparently.
Huh? Because in Casino Royale, the book, she's actually a member of the Secret Service, not the Treasury, as she is in
the number that Shady Tree gives to Bond as a way to contact him in the novel of Diamonds of River. This <That's> mad.
So good.
There's the aliases as well. I love that. The list of the aliases Bond's used.
Yeah, I didn't realize there were so many. I mean, I knew about Mark Hazard, you know, the ones from the movies, and then from I knew the Mark Hazard one from the books, and they use that in a couple of the comic strips as well. But yeah, I think I did count it up. I think it's something like 52 different aliases that he uses. Yeah.
Two of them in A View to a Kill Alone, of course.
Yeah.
Roger loves an alias, doesn't he? I mean, pretty much.
He does.
Film is an alias. He asked for information. Yeah. He has an alias in pretty much every single film.
Sometimes multiple ones, as you quite rightly point out. Yeah. And then if you actually add in the aliases he uses in the View to a Kill Choose Your Own Adventure books, then there's a couple more in there.
Oh.
I've just turned to that.
Which, by the way, which is the first place in a licensed story that James Bond died is in the Choose Your Own Adventure story.
Ooh.
I've just turned to the aliases page, and I think I've found another omission. I'm so sorry. So Robert, doesn't he use Robert Sterling not just in Spy Who Loved Me?
Doesn't he also use it
in Quantum of Solace?
Yes, there is some reference, isn't there? Maybe.
Oh, is it on the business card?
But yeah, that's
it. They didn't say it, so I suppose it's not a character, is it? But
still there.
Yeah, it's on the Universal Export business card.
This is the last time that I get invited on one of these.
I'm so sorry.
That was good. These have nothing to do with me. That was all Alan. So
I'm going to have to go free frame that bit.
It's like with most things in Quantum of Solace, it's about three frames of film. So
that's just about. But I think it's the same point where the guy with the brush who can't actually
brush on
the ground. Yeah,
the hotel one was amazing for me because I was just looking, reading through them. And I realized that Jennifer and I had our honeymoon in one of them in Kathmandu, the Yak and Yeti Hotel.
Cool.
And I was like, when we went there, it was like the most old-worldy James Bond place we'd ever been. And I've been raving about it ever since. And then to see it on that, because it was in one of the Raymond Benson novels, High Time to Kill, which I haven't read yet. So I was just like, oh, amazing. And just to have so many of them listed there. Like you say, I'm now, I think David and his husband do it a lot, don't they? But just love visiting locations and hotels and places Bond has been, bars. And I'm desperate now that hopefully we're out of lockdown. You know, we can sort of go free and visit more of these places now.
Yeah. By the way, I highly recommend High Time to Kill. I think it's Raymond's best book.
Right. Okay. Right. Well,
it's a really good Bond story.
I'm really impressed that in the hotels list, you've got the Rock Hotel in Gibraltar. Because I went for a drink there without realizing what the Bond connection was. And then I got back and read John Gardner's Win, Lose or Die. And I was like, I've had a drink in that hotel.
So, going back to the Raymond Benson. So Raymond is a Texan and he went to college here in Austin. So when one of his books, the first half of the book, Facts of Death, is actually set here in Austin. And the reason I actually got to know Raymond in the first place is I was actually doing some writing for Austin Monthly magazine. And I'd noticed one of the Tex-Mex restaurants chains here in Austin, one of the local chains, had a plaque inside the door that said James Bond ate here. And I was like, I've got to find out more about that. So I did some digging and found out basically it was this book, Facts of Death, was originally set in Austin. And he goes to Chewy's, the Tex-Mex chain in Austin and eats there. And I was like, oh, so who wrote this book? And oh, it's this guy, Raymond Benson. So I reached out to Raymond and we sort of became friends from that point on when I was writing that article. So I read that book without knowing Raymond or his connection to Austin. And the first half of the book is like, oh, I've eaten in that restaurant. I've driven down that road. I know that place. I know that. I was like, that's awesome.
Amazing.
So it's very cool. But we don't deliberately go out and look for Bond locations, but we sort of sometimes stumble onto them. I know last time we were in London, or not last time, but time before that with our daughter and son-in-law, we're just walking down the embankment and I sort of, you know, we're heading towards St. Paul's and we turn around a corner and there's the College of Arms and I just completely geeked out, you know.
We did deliberately go to GoldenEye.
Deliberately go to GoldenEye. I will give you that one.
I know you've been there, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you get the spirit of Fleming when you were there?
We had a lot of spirits. I don't know.
We're not traditionally beach people or sitting by the pool people, but that's all we did.
Yeah, we
did a tour of the Fleming Villa and, you know, wandered around.
And we went up to Noel Coward's house.
Oh, David. It was
very jealous. Yeah, I know David's big to Noel Coward. Yeah, yeah.
That was really sad, actually his house, because it doesn't have any windows, doesn't have any glass. So everything is set out in there as it was when he lived there. And it's all slowly rotting.
Oh. Yeah.
And it was so, I came away, I needed a cocktail when we got back to GoldenEye. It was really sad because it felt, you could feel his character in there. And it was very whimsical and very interesting, but all the books and the soft furnishings were just all rotting because it's, you know, there's shutters, but there's no glass.
So it's just, everything's open to the elements. Yeah. It's really sad.
I found that really sad, but GoldenEye was magical.
Yeah.
And there's no other word for it.
Yeah. I noticed David was looking at the back of the book. There's actually a picture on the back of the book of the two of us at Fleming's desk in GoldenEye. So. Ugh.
And if I'd have known we were going to do that, I would have made sure I looked better than that.
We were on vacation.
We were doing a tour. The lady took a picture and you're just like, then it was like, oh, yeah, we just have to use that one. We'd actually just come back from Firefly.
Yeah, we had not long come back from Noel Coward's place, but yeah. GoldenEye is magic. As Jill said, we're not beach people. We booked it. Talking about big holidays with an O at the end, it was one of my big holidays with an O at the end, birthdays with an O at the end. So we booked it for that. After we booked it, it's like, what do we just do? We just committed to staying a week at a place which is just a beach place, and neither, you know, if we go to the beach, we're usually there an hour, and then we're like, okay, where are we going to go? You know, but we did. We just got in there and we just enjoyed it so much and relaxed so much. We just can't wait to go back. So it really is a magical spot.
Yep.
And we actually have a big frame photograph of the view from our favorite beach at GoldenEye. In our bedroom. So it's the first thing we see when we wake up in the morning is the views.
Brilliant.
So do you stay in a, I know this is turning now into a travel podcast, but do you
does that go with a couples counselling podcast?
Part
of the service. We're more than a podcast, that's the thing, you see.
Service.
That should be a new tagline.
So do you stay in like a villa on the estate? Is that how it works? Because it is
stayed in a beach hut.
Yeah, they have multiple different types. So you can rent the Fleming Villa.
Oh, good lord.
The actual Fleming's Villa.
If you have that much money.
It's expensive, but it also but I think it sleeps up to like 10 people.
Yeah. And you get a chef. You get somebody that comes in with tweezers to tweak the weeds out of the grass.
Yeah, you get a
private chef. Because he was doing that on our tour.
Yeah, you get a private chef and all that sort of stuff. So no, we did not stay there. Then within the actual Fleming Villa grounds, there's like three smaller mini villas, which is one of the ones they pointed out it was the one that Daniel Craig stayed in when they were filming No Time to Die. Shows like how long ago they were filming that movie.
Yeah, yeah. And then
you sort of go across a bridge to the larger part of the property, which is more of the resort part. And there's beachside villas, which sleep four. And then there's beach huts, which sleep two. And they're on stilts and stuff. And we just had one of the beach huts.
That's all you needed. It was lovely.
You just basically need a place to sleep and a shower and bathroom. And, you know, because otherwise you're just sitting at, by the pool or at the bar, just sipping, or eating at one of the restaurants. And it's owned by Chris Blackwell from Island Records, who also owns Blackwell Rum. So, there is a of reggae music playing in the background. You're drinking your rum cocktails or your Vespers.
It was a very relaxed atmosphere. It was very, very, very nice. Let's say one guy, all his job seemed to be all day was raking the beach. That's all he did all day. Make it look nice.
And the staff are great. They're really personal. And they get to know you really quick. They're very good at getting to know you very, very quickly. So
Highly recommend it.
Yeah.
I have a feeling if you stayed in too much luxury, it wouldn't be that Fleming-like experience. Because
it probably wasn't.
I wouldn't have said it was that luxurious, funnily enough. The beach huts are just perfect. You get a bed, an outdoor shower, a bathroom, and a little porch. They're not, it's not a luxurious place. It's kind of toned down luxury. It's very nice.
Didn't Noel Coward say it wasn't GoldenEye? It was GoldenEye ear, nose, and throat.
I mean, you can see that they've actually, it's not as austere as Fleming quite liked it. Particularly the Fleming Villa has been slightly modernized, but it does still feel
running water now.
It does still feel very much like, you can certainly feel his presence there.
Yeah.
They don't play up the bomb thing either. It's not like in your face. Like when the reception area has some photos on the wall and it has the Bond archives, the big red book, which is now blue, like sitting there for you to flick through. But that's it.
That's up great. in the
restaurant, the main restaurant, they've got some location pictures of them filming Dr. No. They've got a whole wall of Ursula Andress pictures. There was a couple of Fleming books in the Fleming Villa, like a couple of biographies, and the great Matthew Parker's book on GoldenEye were sort of in the library of the villa. But that's it. It's not like, there's James Bond stuff all over the place. You could go there. If you don't go to the Fleming Villa, you could go there and not really know
what it was about.
No, it was related to Bond. But if you're a Bond geek, it's like, like we went out on the glass bottom boat over the reef, because neither of us are really good swimmers. So we went out on the glass bottom boat over the reefs, and it's like, it just brought back all those descriptions from Live and Let Die.
Did you see any barracuda?
No.
That's the one thing from the books. I'm like, can you bring those into the film, please?
Yeah. But yeah, it was fantastic just going out over the reefs. And it's like, just the way Fleming described it and you're looking at it. And it was like, oh, this is just amazing. Yeah.
David, please tell me that while Alan and Jill have been talking about this, you've been booking online.
I'm far too polite to have another window open, but it's the first thing I'm going to do when I've got off this.
Yeah. Although I will say, when we went, it worked out happily for us, is the fact that they had closed off some of the area where they were doing some renovations and extensions and some more privately owned villa buildings. So it was cheaper because certain things weren't available, and that's how we were able to go. Because it's not cheap.
If you look at certain times, because we were thinking about going this year for Jill's birthday, but obviously didn't. But like the week of her birthday was really expensive, but if you went a week later, the price had dropped quite dramatically. So if you do want to do it, and as well, it is affordable if you plan what time of year you go and stuff.
I said, I'm beholden to school holidays, unfortunately, which might be right, a good thing. But if, being as it is a significant rounded number birthday next year, I might be just dropping some not so subtle hints. like
yeah, that's true.
Playing Tina Turner on repeat every morning, you know, until he...
I will say the best Vespa martinis I've ever had was, was fittingly at GoldenEye.
Just stop it now. Stop it now.
David's prepared to...
Going back to a bit more general, when we go places, if it has anything to do with Bond, like Alan was in Hong Kong, so I kept getting pictures of, oh, I was here and I was here, you know.
Yeah, last time I was in New Orleans, I had to go and find Soda's lamppost and stand there.
We did that on our honeymoon.
Yeah, you did.
I'm lucky. I normally do quite a bit of business travel. So if I'm going somewhere that has a Bond connection.
Amazing.
My big miss is Bond Island. I was in Thailand. I was in Phuket on business. We had a spare weekend and a colleague of mine was like, let's go to Bond Island. I'm like, yeah, duh. And then I ate the wrong thing the night before.
And
so I couldn't go. And I missed my trip to Bond Island, which is still a bit of a regret.
You disagreed with something that ate him.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Very good.
Good.
What you mentioned about Raymond Benson and knowing Raymond, and you also just dropped into conversation that you'd you chatted to George Lazenby about that statement.
Yeah, yeah.
Is there any other people in the Bond world that you've had contact with and maybe interviewed or had any feedback from the book about or anything like that?
We've met Maud Adams.
Yeah, we've had dinner with Maud Adams and Lana Wood. That was an entertaining evening.
Oh, and what's her name? The lady who played Thumper. We've met her too.
Oh, Trina Park.
Oh, yes. We've had the pleasure of her company.
She's very tall.
Yeah.
Dinner with Maud Adams and Lana Wood was good. Maud didn't actually get to say much because we wind Lana up. She tells lots of great stories. a lot of interesting Diamonds of Forever behind the scenes.
Yeah.
No, David.
We've heard a bit about this before.
I
did a review of Diamonds Are Forever with David, and I think we spent about half an hour talking about Lana Wood's background and relationships and various things. It was a gossip thriller.
About the book, no.
Not directly from any of the cast or anything like that, no, any of the cast members. Again, it is, you know, just through the people we've met, it's sort of these things, you know, you get drawn into it. So always take the opportunity. Yeah, unfortunately, the night we went out with Maud and Lana, actually Richard Keel was meant to be with us as well for that event, for that dinner. And unfortunately, it was the weekend that he fell and broke his leg, and then he passed away a couple of days later. So it was sort of his last weekend. And he was actually meant to be out at the same event we were at. But that was a bit sad. But it was a really entertaining evening with those two.
Yeah.
And Trina's good fun too.
Yeah.
And how was George?
George was interesting. It was back when my previous book came out, back in 2009. He and several of the girls, and I'm terrible, I can't remember which of the Bond girls it was at San Diego Comic-Con, and Eon had done nothing to promote the fact they were there. I didn't even know they were there. I just actually went up. Whenever I go to a Comic-Con, I always walk. I don't get autographs. I don't stand in line for autographs and that. But I always walk through the autograph areas just to see who's there. Walk around the corner, and right at the back is... set up is George and three of the Bond girls with a table. I'm like, okay. So I actually had some spare copies of the book because my publisher was there. So I sort of ran down, grabbed a copy of the book, ran back out, and I signed it and gave it to George and said, and he went, you'll like this, the diamond. So he flicked through it, and there's a Majesty's poster on it. And he was like, oh yeah, that's cool. And then he flicked over and there's a diamonds poster was like on the next page. And he said, yeah, Connery did a pretty good impersonation of me in that follow-up.
Oh, meow.
But he was good. He was joking, but he was having a bit of a bitch about the fact that nobody knew they were there and what was the point, you know, if they weren't going to publicize the fact they were there. But we ended up chatting for, I don't know, probably half an hour or so. He was really good. He was really nice. So.
Well, a lot's happened since then that his legacy is, thankfully, I mean, in No Time to Die alone is...
Yeah.
Obviously he's been involved in, you know, he comes out to, you know, he went out to the Majesty's 50th anniversary thing at Pistoria, and he seems to be really getting engaged in it.
Brilliant. Right. Well, thank you for coming and joining us this very early for you guys. I really appreciate
that. Yeah, thank you so much. Alan,
no problem. Oh, you're welcome.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Next time, I'll try and remember what the exact time difference is.
Just for the listeners' benefit, where can we purchase your book?
Okay, so the aforementioned website that I said, jamesbondlexicon.online, yep, has links to all the places online that you can buy it. So, but obviously Amazon is the main one. You can find it on all the global Amazon sites. But if you don't want to use Amazon, we have a list of all the other online book dealers that you can get it from at the jamesbondlexicon.online website.
It's a really good website. No, it's got loads of your appearances and anything you're doing up to date and the podcast. And
yeah, you might also find links to all our Honor Majesty's Secret podcast network shows on there as well.
Awesome. So like I said at the start of the episode, I can't recommend this enough. If you haven't got it in time for Christmas, it's still there, and we'll be watching Bonds throughout the new year. So do get a copy. I can't recommend it enough.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay.
No, thanks.
Thanks for having us. Good morning.
Yeah. And now I have to go and get my BMW Z3 model off the shelf in the office and check it out.
Yes. If I've got this wrong, I am so sorry. That's all I'll say. Really, Douglas.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.